Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Iraq enters its fourth year. President Bush today kicks off another series of speeches to try to bolster sliding public opinion on the war. This time his audience will be at the City Club of Cleveland, Ohio, which describes itself as the nation's oldest continuous free speech forum. The president will take questions from the audience, something he's been more willing to do lately. The president is expected to highlight one success story in restoring order in Iraq, in the northern Iraqi city of Tal Afar, where the U.S. is now maintaining a true presence after repeated sweeps of insurgents failed to keep them from coming back. Joining us on the line is reporter Sabrina Eaton. She covers Washington for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And Sabrina, why Ohio?
Well, I mean, the president obviously hasn't told me why he's made these decisions, but a lot of politicians in Ohio feel that Ohio is pretty reflective of the nation in terms of being a swing state, and that a lot of people in Ohio, like the way a message goes down there, would be somewhat reflective of how it would go down all around the country.
Well, let's ask how you think some things might go down. The president was criticized yesterday for not uttering the word war on the third anniversary of the invasion. He instead referred to the third anniversary of the beginning of the liberation of Iraq. Any sense of how that might play politically in Ohio?
Well, Cleveland itself is pretty democratic. It's my understanding, though, that most of the tables that were sold at this thing were sold to corporate groups. Now, as you're probably aware, President Bush is pretty popular with corporate America, so I think that this audience that he's going to be speaking before may not be necessarily representative of the hoi polloi.
Yeah, we're very aware of Cleveland and other cities in Ohio that have had a lot of losses in this war.
Yes, as a matter of fact, there was a very big, I'd say about a dozen young men from Brook Park, a National Guard that was based in Brook Park. So a lot of these guys were from the Cleveland area, and a whole bunch of them were killed, like in one fell swoop, I believe it was last July. And, the city was really pretty shaken by that.
Yeah. Well, what's been the tone in the lead-up to this speech? We understand it was completely sold out, but also that some prominent Ohio Republicans won't be attending.
Why, yes, that's the case. I was prowling Capitol Hill last week and just sort of bumped into a bunch of them, and they all had other things to do. Mike DeWine, who's a senator facing re-election, is going to be in Florida with his father, who's had he's recovering, I think, from some kind of ailment, and so he's going to be going to spring training baseball games with his dad. George Voinovich, who was the former mayor of Cleveland, who's another U.S. senator from Ohio, he said he had business in Washington today. Another prominent local congressman, Steve LaTourette, who represents an area pretty much to the east of Cleveland, he's not going to be there either. He scheduled his staff retreat a long time ago, and they just couldn't reschedule everybody.
And Congress is in recess this week, as we can tell from
recess.
So it would have been a perfect time for people to visit with the president in their hometown.
Furthermore, neither of the two main Ohio Republican gubernatorial candidates are going to be there either, their spokesman told me last week.
Sabrina Eaton, a reporter for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, speaking from Washington. Sabrina, thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we turn now to Richard Wolff. He's the senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. And, Richard, we just heard of the lawmakers who aren't attending today. And, we can see the polls. Your article this week is headlined, "Is Anyone Listening?" as the president heads out on the road. What did you mean by that?
Well, the Ohio problems for the president are a perfect example of everything that's troubling the White House and the party as they head towards these November elections. And really, the biggest problem they have as they look at these polls and think about possible defeat in November is how to deal with the president himself. Should they run as W Republicans, as they like to call themselves, or run as something more independent? And that's why, basically, you have a number of politicians in Ohio who welcome the president's money and all the cash he can raise at these kinds of events, but don't want to be seen with him. And that's exactly what Mike DeWine did last time around. He's in a very tough race. He attended a private fundraiser. There were no photographers, no journalists, but didn't want to be seen in public with the president. And that's a very unusual situation, both for Republicans and for the White House.
But Richard Wolff, is the president now in a very tough spot in that we see the latest polling from the Pew Center in which Americans used a new word to describe the president when asked to think of the one word they would use. It was incompetent. A while back, that word they chose was honest. Democrats have seized on that word. If President Bush were to go out on the road and talk about failures in Iraq, as opposed to the positive side of Iraq, wouldn't it just play into that perception of that word?
Yeah, it is a problem. They have a very difficult calculation about how honest they want to be and how open and in admitting mistakes. And, of course, the president himself, there's a certain amount of pride there. His friends will tell you he doesn't like to admit mistakes in public. He thinks it's part of a sort of political gotcha game. But he is still the strongest pull for the Republican Party, not just in terms of money he can raise, but he's still more popular with voters and with the base than congressional Republicans. And that's what's difficult for anyone thinking about their own re-election fight in November, because as bad as the president is, their own prospects are actually worse.
Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine, as the president speaks in Cleveland, Ohio today. Richard, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, joining us now to take another look at Iraq from her unique perspective is Nesreen Barwari. She is Iraq's Minister for Municipalities and Public Works and is currently spending the semester as a visiting scholar at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Thank you so much for joining us. I know that the formal title is Madam Minister.
Yes.
But you've also said I can call you Nesreen.
Of course. Yeah.
So thank you so much for coming into our studios today. And let's talk a little bit about the perception of Iraq. President Bush and others in the White House saying there is no civil war there yet. But as we heard, former Iraqi Prime Minister Ayad Alawi said yesterday that Iraq is now in the midst of civil war. That phrase, your sense of it.
Well, yes, I can resonate with both talks, if we can say. There are elements that could develop into a civil war. There are actions and reactions that are taking place in Iraq today, especially on the last 3 weeks since the bombing of the Al-Askariya shrine in Samarra. Those elements could lead to a civil war. We cannot call it, and the country is still functioning. The people are still attending schools and going to offices, so we cannot tell. But there is a lot of intimidation. There is a lot of fear. And if things does not get into control, and if the leaders and the political elites do not do anything about it, it could develop to a civil war.
But why would Alawi say it was a civil war now?
Well, there is a lot of political rhetoric these days in Iraq. It's a very sensitive period, formation of national unity government. There is a lot of challenging issue. Of course, there is competition. But I said that I would agree there are elements of civil war. I did not disagree.
And we want to take a second to just give some of the news from today. Roadside bombings killed at least 7 police officers in Iraq, 35 people killed yesterday. Authorities say they found 10 more bodies in Baghdad today, including a 13-year-old girl. Authorities say they were executed and believe that these killings were part of the violence that we're seeing, the sectarian violence between Shiite and Sunni Muslims. So far, that violence has claimed 700 lives since the bombing of the Shiite mosque. Can you give us a sense of, as an Iraqi, how this is resonating, especially in Baghdad, this sectarian violence?
Well, there is combination of things in Baghdad that has taken place and in Iraq in general. It is the terrorist, targeting of certain activities and of certain people to create the element of sectarian violence, which has been happening.
Terrorists, Al-Qaeda in Iraq,
Definitely. Outsider, also former loyalists to the former regime who don't want to have a new Iraq. And then, of course, there are elements of sectarian divides between that has been created because of some wrong action during the coalition provisional authority time and some wrong action during the both interim and transitional government by the authorities and by the some of the political who are in charge now. So it's very sad. If I could tell you, having been involved in Iraq before the liberation of of Iraq and after, the things, the way they are developing, there is a deterioration.
Have you seen, because you are so much a part of Iraq, have you seen Shiites and Sunnis who were neighbors turn against you? Have you seen this from your own eyes?
Of course not. I cannot see it because, Iraq is such a mixed society. I live in a neighborhood that has mixed. I know friends who are married. Different groups there are mixed marriages. I run a ministry that has staff from across the different sects and ethnicity and religious backgrounds, and we all work together.
So you don't see it?
I don't see it at the work. Maybe because I promote a sense of Iraqiness, but it does exist in some of the neighborhoods. It does exist in some of the areas that are completely either one side or the other who has been targeted. I know people who have seen it. I hear stories of random, arrest of people for nothing just because they are who they are. So, unfortunately, we do have cases and elements that could develop into the road of no return, as Prime Minister Allawi said.
Well, and we want to touch on other violence that's happening and perhaps overshadowed somewhat because of the Shiite-Sunni sectarian violence, and that's the intra-violence between Kurds. You are a Kurd. Last week, Kurds in Halabja rioted and burned down the museum that was a monument to victims of Hussein's 1998 poison gas attack that killed so many. We also saw those images, and some forgot. This is sort of the forgotten tensions between different Kurdish groups. What did you make of that violence?
Well, first of all, I like to just state one thing. This was not generated because of inter-Kurdish violence. This is public unsatisfaction with their government, and this is a democratic practice of rights. So what I see, because I visited the area a few months ago, and the area is dominated by one party, and I come from a different party.
Right, you're for the minority party, the Kurdistan Democratic Party.
It's not a minority party. It's both are basically having equal control of the region. And now they are attempting to unify their administration. But back to the point, this was not inter-party conflict, but this was public dissatisfaction of services. And I can understand why people could be angry. But what shocked me was that their anger could go to the point destroying that monument, which was their monument, which was visited by foreign leaders, by a lot of prominent politicians, where a lot of promises were made and did not happen. So I can understand at one point why people are angry, because the region is very neglected. On the other hand, I think all Iraq should feel responsible for that city. And I would hope that one day a national program could be implemented for that city too, because it's a city that will live in our history because of Saddam's atrocity.
Nesrine Barari, Iraq's Minister for Municipalities and Public Works. She's currently spending the semester as a visiting scholar at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Well, when we come back, Madam Minister, let's talk more about rebuilding the country and the things that are needed so that people don't burn down monuments, and also your own personal story, how you suffered at the hands of Saddam Hussein, and your family did as well. We'll have all of that with Nesrine Barwari when we come back. Much more ahead, here and now. Barwari. She is Iraq's Minister for Municipalities and Public Works. She's currently spending the semester as a visiting scholar at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. So we welcome her to our studios. Glad you could come across the river as it is to our studios. And Madam Minister, you're much more than Iraq's minister. You are, as we mentioned, a Kurd. And by the way, I want to clarify, I said that you are a member of the minority party. I meant that the other party is in ruling power right now. And you also are married to a Sunni from Mosul who served as interim president of Iraq from 2004 to 2005. So you have a lot to do with the patchwork that is Iraq's past history, including your history as a child. You were 14 years old when you and your family were taken as political prisoners by Saddam Hussein's regime. What happened?
Well, one night they just came back as they used to come, the security people. And after midnight, my father said, this time they won't let us, they will take us. So at 14 years of old, with my old father and mother and six other brothers, we were taken.
Why?
I belong to a family who has political stand that is against the regime. We had Kurdish aspiration. We were part of Kurdish resistance movement. But also we were fighting the regime, I mean, by being part of a wider range of people who were struggling, who were seeing the beginning of a dictatorship. And of course, I come from a tribe and a region that has their villages destroyed. My close relatives, uncles and aunts, became refugees in Turkey and Iran in the 70s. Just because of they were Kurds, and because Saddam had this plan of eradicating Kurds in the border areas, but also uprooting them by moving them.
Did you survive? Did you go to prison?
Of course, for 1 year we were in prison, and I was with hundreds other women in the women prison, women who comes from different background and political ideology, and we all were united that we were just anti-Ba'athist, and we struggled and fought and expressed opinions that are not in line with the Ba'athist regime. And because who we are and whose our backgrounds are, we were in that prison. We were 30 women in one room, and I remember, you know, our entertainment time would be listening to each other's time and why we are there. And even after that, of course, that didn't, after 1 year we were released, and but we continued that move as a family and as a person. And I took part in the uprising against Saddam in 91. And when the uprising failed, we just fled to Turkey and was a refugee for 2-3 months. But only after the creation of the safe haven in the Kurdish region that I was able to return back.
And you've become involved in Iraqi politics. You served in three interim national governments in Baghdad as Master of Municipalities and Public Works, as we said. But even you know, you don't avoid violence at all, of course. Do we understand you narrowly escaped an assassination attempt in 2004?
There were three assassination attempts against me. One time when I was visiting a water project in Karbala, so in the road to Karbala. And then there was another one, 2004, in Mosul, and two of my bodyguards were killed. And then there was recent one few months ago, actually 2 months ago, in close to between Baghdad and Kirkuk, which is the also a hot area where there is a lot of attempts there. So I almost was going to be killed three times, and I survived it.
And meantime, you're trying to get the water turned on. What is the problem? Because it seems to be one of the biggest complaints of Iraqis, getting the things that we come to take for granted, water and electricity, turned back on. What's the biggest problem?
Well, the biggest problem is that there was a problem even under Saddam regime. You know, for 35 years, this regime have neglected services, bad management of public money, and then the sanction. So by the end of 2002, beginning of 2003, we already had very bad infrastructure. You know, half of the population used to only have water. Electricity was only full-time in Baghdad. That. But the rest of the country didn't have enough electricity because all electricity would go to Baghdad. And then the effect of the looting and the burning and but also after 2003, the public services installation are being targeted by the terrorist group and insurgents just to
cause havoc. And as you say, perhaps because of that, $250 million was cut from your ministry budget and diverted to American military commanders for their projects. Is that to help? Is there a vicious cycle here of we have to protect reconstruction, but in taking money away to pay for reconstruction, to pay for the military, we can't do the reconstruction?
Well, it's going to take much more than that to restore the infrastructure. The minimum needs estimated by the World Bank and the UN assessment team is $70 billion needed to get the basic services of water, electricity, health and education. So, of course, security is important for the acceleration of reconstruction, but also for the implementation and the continuation of projects.
And then just the couple minutes we have, do you think, I mean, there's been a lot of criticism of the American companies that are acting as middlemen, getting some of these reconstruction projects started. Do you think that the Iraqis can handle this on their own now? Do you think the American companies should be taken out?
We need to take another outlook to the way we do reconstruction. Iraqi private sector, we do have a wide range of Iraqi private sector entities who has been doing a lot of reconstruction work under Saddam and even after Saddam. And they are being used, same one are being used by the, subcontracted by the American companies. So a new vision for reconstruction need to take in the center and core of it, empowerment of Iraqi private sector, empowerment of Iraqi institution, use of the Iraqi utility, that will cut cost and detract attention to for targeting and minimize cost. And that's what we need.
And yet, Nesrine Barwari, in just the few seconds we have, should the U.S. leave now?
No, it will be a big mistake for them to leave. We still need them. They still need to influence their pressure and help Iraq get through this critical period.
Nesrine Barwari, Iraq's Minister for Municipalities and Public Works, thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston.
Dramatic battles of the civil rights movement unfolded in Birmingham, Alabama in the 50s and 60s. Violence often broke out as activists tried to integrate buses, lunch counters, and schools. The most deadly attack happened on September 15, 1963, when a bomb went off at the 16th Street Baptist Church, killing four black girls. Well, now thousands of photos from that era have been discovered at the Birmingham News, providing an historical account that's never before been seen. While the Birmingham News did print some photos from that era, these newly discovered pictures prompted the paper to admit that its coverage of race relations in the 60s was marked by mistakes and embarrassments. Alex Cohn was an intern at the paper who recently found the negatives. He joins us from the studios of WBHM in Birmingham. And Alex, we understand you were rummaging through an equipment closet when you came across these packets of negatives. What'd you find?
What you see on several of the packets is the phrase, keep, do not sell. And this was written on packets holding the negatives from several events, most of which had instances of a white mob action in the city. And the editors wanted to downplay this. They didn't want these images to get out.
What were some of the other images?
There's images of Lamar Weaver facing a white mob.
Lamar Weaver being a white civil rights activist.
That's right. He had gone to join Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, who was there integrating the train station in Birmingham in 1957.
That's one image. Yet another is from the Birmingham church bombing period. It's a photograph of Mayor Albert Boutwell. He's just received word of the bombing of the church. He looks utterly defeated. That photo was taken by Robert Adams. He's an 85-year-old retired photojournalist now. He's also joining us on the line. Mr. Adams, how did you feel about your photos not being shown?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's just part of the life of a photographer. It still is. You know, you shoot a lot of pictures. Some get shown, some don't get shown. Basically, it's an editorial decision. And it's not the decision of a photographer whether or not something gets in the paper. It's his job to shoot it, cover it, do it right. But it's not his decision that it gets in the paper. You always differ with editors. You know, that's a basic tenet of journalism. The editors don't know what they're doing. You know, it wasn't all that upsetting. There are pictures I thought were pretty good and I liked that I felt it should have been in the paper. But I certainly didn't dwell on it or lose sleep over it. I felt like I'd been wronged or anything of that sort. It was just a way to part of the, you know, the system was set up like that.
I'm looking at some of the pictures now. These are the pictures, of course, that Alex found. And this is one from 1957 when a white mob is trying to overturn Lamar Weaver's car. We mentioned Lamar Weaver before, the white civil rights supporter of some black activists. I mean, that looks like a pretty tense situation. Robert Adams, do you remember how it felt to be in the middle of some of these photos, taking them?
Well, I remember that Weaver ended pretty well. I don't know why. You know, some things stay in your mind, some don't. So they had Weaver's car, I called it cornered. And, you know, just a mob surrounding the car and trying to get at him. And, of course, I just walked up, started shooting pictures. Nobody bothered me. Nobody tried to restrain me. It was an act that was going on. It was my job to photograph it, which I did.
Did you feel, Bob Adams, that you were at an important moment in history?
I was pretty cognizant of the whole civil rights movement generally, you know, but I didn't think this was a historic moment.
And it turned out to be. Alex Cohn, I'm wondering, again, you're the intern who found these pictures and interviewed other photographers as well. Did most photographers just feel like they were just doing their job? Did people really get it, what was happening on the other side of their lens?
I guess, really, you know, you don't get a full sense of history until, a lot of times, until after it happened. I mean, that's true with Tommy Langston as well, who was shooting for the rival paper, the Birmingham Post-Herald, when he went to the Birmingham Trailway station in 1961 on Mother's Day. And, of course, he made one frame of a mob attacking the Freedom Riders before he was himself attacked and ended up in the hospital and then in hiding for 7 weeks. And he will tell you that he was there doing his job.
I'm looking at a picture now, one of Bob's pictures of some high school students in 63 outside of their school protesting the enrollment of two black girls and the jeering look of hatred on their face. And another photo here, this one's by Vernon Merritt. This is of the mother of Denise McNair, who was one of the little girls who was killed in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. And it's just the vacant look on her face. Alex, what do you hope these pictures will do now?
This has become really the legacy of Birmingham and something that our experience as a city can teach the world. And I wanted these pictures to be in print for other people to see, maybe to bring some sort of healing to the city, really. And for scholars, for historians to go back and see what happened, you can see things unfolding by the frame numbers.
What about journalists? What's the opinion now of what the newspaper did, which is really keeping news photos, you know, out of the paper?
Well, can I interject something?
Sure.
I disagree with the interpretation. They kept them out of the paper. We had pictures in the paper on a daily basis. They might not have been prominent. They just played. Just some people might think they should have been. Quite often they're on the inside when, in some people's judgments, they should have been on page one. You get into a judgment situation. But to say that we did not suppress pictures, we covered the story. We didn't cover it in a manner that might felt appropriate to a lot of people.
These images were downplayed. For example, on May the 8th, 1963, there were street protests throughout Birmingham, and one of the strategies of the editors was to keep that news off of the front page. It might have been on the front page of the New York Times every day that week, but it was always on the inside pages of the news.
And Bob Adams, I mean, we picked up that you feel the need to defend, the paper. And I'm wondering, I bet there are people who think that the paper did the right thing in putting these pictures inside. So
well, I would throw the question out there. If I think anybody of any intelligence in that era would admit to some great changes of heart. You know, it's not a great sudden enlightenment or anything. It's just change of heart. People's attitudes change.
You're saying, you know, we have to remember the time, the era that it was.
That's correct. And, you know, you have to sort of think in the framework of 50 years ago and the way things were. I'm not defending it. I'm just saying that's the situation as it was. And people's feelings evolve over the years. Some people's feelings harden. Some people take a softer view toward things.
That's photographer Bob Adams. We also spoke with Alex Cohn, an intern at the Birmingham News in Alabama, who recently discovered photos taken by Bob and others in the 50s and 60s that have provoked a lot of conversation in Birmingham about whether the paper did all it could to cover the civil rights era. Gentlemen, I want to thank you both.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Well, thank you very much. I hope it has some help. And, sound like I'm picking a fight with you, but I'm not.
No, not at all.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Right.
And you can see some of these newly discovered images at our website, here-now.org. Well, still to come, what a lovely adiendum pedatum. What's that, you say? Well, we'll find out. Author Anna Payford is coming up. You have to hear her on naming plants. That's still ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. As the war in Iraq enters its fourth year, several small towns in Vermont are dealing with a backlash from votes taken at town meeting approving resolutions calling for the impeachment of President Bush. The impeachment resolution was first approved at town meeting in Newfane and then by four other towns, and it's on the agenda for town meeting in Brattleboro this weekend. Sabina Haskell is editor of the Brattleboro Reformer, and Sabina, we understand that most of the backlash is being directed at Newfane. That was the first town to pass the resolution.
The local business association there, sort of like a chamber of commerce, has gotten some calls. A couple of the inns and the restaurants have gotten some calls from some would-be tourists who say that they're going to not return. And, you know, some emails that have been anonymous have been kind of vile. But generally speaking, the big backlash has been against our congressman, who did not jump on board as quickly as everybody had hoped.
Oh, so you're talking about a different kind of backlash. Let's explain. Congressman Bernie Sanders, he's an independent from Vermont, running for Senate. These resolutions that were passed by these small towns asked him to file articles of impeachment.
That's right. And he initially told us through written statements that he did not see the point in going to that effort, that, you know, with a Republican-controlled Congress, that it was, you know, kind of fruitless. And then quietly, unbeknownst to anybody, on the 9th, 2 days after town meeting, he actually did sign on to the impeachment bill, and didn't tell anybody, which is not like the congressman, but he went ahead and did that. And most of the letters that we've received have been about the fact that he should have jumped on board with that, and a lot of people have been kind of angry with the business folks in Newfane for suggesting that that people should not speak up and speak out against the war and against the president. So it's been that's where the emotion has been.
You say there hasn't been as much backlash against these small towns and their resolutions. We're reading that in Newfane, for instance, 68 senior citizens who had planned a bus tour canceled. Others have canceled the reservations at the Four Columns Inn there in Newfane, and that they're getting a lot of hate mail from across the country.
Well, that does not surprise me that there's been a lot of hate mail. There was a lot of hate mail after the Judge Cashman decision that you'll probably remember, where the sentence for the sex offender was so light, and everybody was clogged with hate mail there. In comparison, this seems, you know, quite small. And just as many people from all over the country are writing and saying, you know, you go, Newfane. And so whether those will translate into tourist visits or not, we don't know. And you're always going to have some kind of, you know, some kind of outrage about these kinds of things, but it's not anything like what we saw after the Judge Cashman decision.
That was a local decision, again, as you said, about a sex offender who got a light sentence. There also was, I'm sure, a huge response when Vermont became the first state in the union to offer civil unions. So relative to those, perhaps not a lot. And could you remind us, Sabina, what's the importance of these town meetings and these resolutions that are passed in town meeting?
Well, town meeting in New England and town meeting in Vermont is, you know, just a sacred tradition, and it's where all of the town business, the first Tuesday of every March, gets conducted. The local select boards are elected. The school boards are elected. Decisions are made about, you know, road paving and projects and such, and it's also the time where people in these little towns get to stand up and talk about what is bothering them or what they're, you know, what the issues are of the day. And it's a very, very classic Vermont tradition to take up issues that of a national importance and not just limit it to local town politics. You'll probably remember last year there were 40 towns in Vermont that passed resolutions to bring the Vermont National Guard home as well.
Sabina Haskell from the Brattleboro Reformer, can you just tell us what are some of the other things that are on the on the town meetings agendas this year?
Here in Windham County, there was a lot of focus put on to evacuation plans and emergency planning. Another non-binding resolution about the education fund of about in the late 90s, the state took over education funding. It used to be handled at the local level. Increasingly, they've been taking that money and rather than spending it on K-12 education, starting to dip into it for other expenses. And in 150 towns, they voted that that money should stay for education and directed the governor and lawmakers to make sure that that in fact happens.
Sabina Haskell of the Brattleboro Reformer speaking to us from Brattleboro, Vermont. Sabina, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Anna Pavord ahead here and now.
Mm-hmm.
Today, the first day of spring, gardeners everywhere are looking for inspiration. And many are finding it at flower shows. This past weekend, we attended the New England Flower Show at the Boston Expo Center here in Boston. There, towering above the Tulipa Batalina, was British gardening reporter Anna Pavord. Her new book is called The Naming of Names, The Search for Order in the World of Plants. It's sort of a history of the language of botany. How do plants get their names? Well, we met up with Anna at her favorite display. It was designed by Massachusetts landscape artists Paul Miskovsky and David Haskell and featured clumps of white daffodils.
Everything that you're looking at on this stand is really fascinating. Beautiful thalia, narcissus. And the lovely thing about thalia is it's got several heads on a stem. So that instead of just getting the one daff, you've got two or three, and it's a white trumpet and a white corona around it. And the whole thing is just so light-limbed and lovely. And by the side of it, there's a hebe in full bloom, and I just dived my nose straight into the middle of that bush and thought, oh, boy, I remember that smell.
Wait, let's go smell.
For us in England, it's been such a long time since one's been able to get that smell.
Oh, that's beautiful. Isn't that beautiful?
It's like a honey pot. You know, when you take the lid off, a pot of honey, and that wonderful scent comes out of the jar.
And I'll try to describe this plant. It looks like a fireworks display, the kind where the fireworks goes off and then each little firework explodes, in this case, in a little white ball.
That's right. And what's so clever about the staging is that he hasn't just plopped down one of something. He's given you drifts of them. For instance, in this planting here, there's three of these hebe bushes, and interspersed amongst them are these white thalia daffodils we were talking about, lovely tall spires of purple honesty, which is, you know, almost a weed with us, but just exactly
purple honesty?
Honesty is this plant here, Lunaria annua.
It does look like a weed. It looks like something you see on the side of the road, tall green with a purple flower on the end.
That's right, but those purple flowers turn into the most wonderful silvery discs, you know, pennies. We used to play with them as money when we were children. But in this setting, which is semi-wild, it's exactly right. And that's what I love about this garden. I could live in this garden. It feels real. Should we just go to this New England flower?
Sure, the wildflower stand. Okay, here we are.
And I'm standing in front of a fern, which actually is rather rare with us. It's Adiantum pedatum. It's a maidenhair fern, very, very elegant, a tall, dark, very thin stem. And then this lovely whirl of fronds at the top.
Do me a favor. Can you break down the Adiantum pedatum? What is that?
Pedatum means looking like a foot. That's very much like the mark that a rather large-footed bird would put down. If you imagine a turkey, for instance, you know, putting down its footmark would look much like the top of that fern, wouldn't it?
Sure, if it had five foot fingers coming out.
Exactly, pedatum, which is the second part of that special name, that, you know, botanic sort of Latin name, is often a descriptive name like that.
Now, why name that? You know, it's a fern, and obviously you want to know which fern, but why? Why further would people name things like ferns? Why was that important?
I think because man can't stand the idea that he's living in a world of chaos. We're always looking for symmetry, for order, for a sense of resolution. And the first guy that ever actually asked those questions was a Greek, Theophrastus, 200 years before Christ was ever born. He was saying, look, what are the things we've got all growing here? What should we be calling them? What are the similarities? What are the differences? Which of these plants can we group together as saying, well, that's much like that. They're probably a sort of group of things that share characteristics. But nobody knew which would be the right characteristic. Some people went off and thought that the leaf would be a good way of grouping things. Other people thought that the habit of growth was the right way. I mean, so nobody could actually work out where this order was to be found. And the story I'm telling is actually the search for order. Not because the plants need it. It doesn't matter to them whether they've got a name or not. It matters to us in a curious way. And there can't be debate about these things until we all know that we're talking about the same thing. And that really was the root of why it's Latin that we see at the top of these plant labels here, because in the medieval age in Europe, Latin was like a sort of Esperanto. Anybody who could speak or could read or write read and wrote in Latin.
It's so funny that you say that this idea of naming plants came out of some desire on the part of man to bring order to this natural world, because really in cases like mine, it's a world that really very few of us can control.
Yeah, I don't think we should control it too much. The control is only in the sense of actually being able to pin a label on something. You know, I was riding with Kazakh horsemen through the mountains in Tian Shan, and it was there very obvious that actually I couldn't have a debate with these guys because we weren't able to speak the same language. I spoke English with a bit of Latin on the side. They spoke Kazakh with a bit of Russian on the side. But I saw some fantastic Juno iris growing up in these mountains, and I wanted somebody to talk to about it. I wanted to check whether I was really looking at Iris orchioides. And Iris orchioides is pointless when you're with a Kazakh horseman. He just knows it as Ukrop, Ukrop. And he could see that I was enormously excited, and he kept jumping up and down in the saddle and saying, Ukrop, Ukrop. But I mean, outside Kazakhstan, Ukrop means nothing. So we can't actually exchange information. Whereas with Iris orchioides hung around its neck, as I say, it doesn't matter to the plant at all, but it means that I can go to somebody, you know, in France or Italy, or come here to the States to a plantsman and say, I saw the most phenomenal orchid, iris up in the Tian Shan Mountains. And this person will say, what iris was it? And I will be able to say, it was Iris orchioides. So it has a sort of technical point.
Could you give the starting gardener just a few words, and I'm almost asking you for a laundry list here, of just a few more of the family names so we can...
The families actually have evolved over a very, very long period, and they often work on things like the shape of the stem. My mother, when I was about 3 years old, used to march me out on these amazing great walks and take my hand and make me sort of feel a dead nettle and say, look, feel the squareness of the stem, labiate, labiate. And actually, it's called labiate because the flower that goes with the square stem has got a lip, and she would take my finger and wobble it on the lip of the flower. And so labiate, if you know any Latin at all, means lips. And other things, for instance, like a particular large range of flowers are called the cruciferae, and that's because their leaves are always held in a cross shape on the stem. And cruciferae means cross, you know, crucifixion. It's a sort of a word that's easily remembered. So the easiest plant families are the ones that have that sort of vivid and immediate symbolism. The problem is, and it was a sort of postscript to my book, that there's work going on now analysing the DNA of plants. They're now discovering that all the old families that have been in existence for hundreds and hundreds of years are all going to be thrown into the air. And in fact, the rose and the nettle belong in the same family, which is not how most of us were brought up at all.
What will you do?
I shall go on. Fortunately, I'm old enough to be able to become a real old sort of Luddite on this. And roses will always belong to Rosaceae, and nettles will always belong to Urticaceae, and I shall go on. What my children will do, what my grandchildren will do, heaven knows. But it's all riveting. And I find that sort of inquiring quality of the human mind incredibly touching, actually. All that I hope is that it doesn't detach us too much from the natural world, because I think many of the disasters that are happening around us now are because too many people are somehow brought up far away from, as it were, the calendar that really matters. And a calendar that's got nothing to do with the possible arrival of trains or car services. It's got to do with the rising and the setting of the sun and the temperature rising and falling and the great diurnal round, as the 19th century poets used to call it. And if we can stitch back into that, then there's a chance of our salvation. And the wonderful thought that I have when I get really gloomy about this is that we can be wiped off the face of the earth. That doesn't really matter to me very much indeed. But these plants, they'll survive because they were here for so long before we were even a blip on the horizon. They know about survival.
Anna Pavord's new book is The Naming of Names, The Search for Order in the World of Plants. To see pictures from the New England Flower Show, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news.